Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's kind of one of the joys of summer is to go out there and harvest okra. It takes off. You find new ones every day. There's always a few that you've forgotten, and they get too big. And
that's Chef Daniel Orr walking through his massive garden, picking ingredients for our recipe today. Sure, everyone likes deep-fried okra, but what about eating it raw? He'll be preparing a colorful and flavorful salad using all sorts of raw veggies, including okra. Then Traditional Arts Indiana takes a look at the unsung hero for every food preserver, the jar. Josephine McRavi visits Muncie, Indiana, to learn more about the history of the Ball Corporation. And Harvest Public Media investigates the changing dairy industry in Kansas. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. Mia Partlow brings us the foodie news updates at the top of every show. Thanks for being here, Mia.
You bet. I've got four stories today. Hurricane Isaac could have a big impact on Indiana farms this weekend, as 7 inches of rain are in the forecast for parts of the state. This could spell relief for Indiana's beleaguered soybean crop. August rains have increased the predicted yield by 2 bushels. But corn crops might not fare as well. Heavy rainfall and gusty winds could topple corn plants, complicating things for the fall harvest. Muddy fields could also leave crops more susceptible to disease. The storm's full impact likely won't be known until late next week. And last week, we reported on a salmonella outbreak in cantaloupes. This week, it's mangoes. 103 people have fallen ill in 16 states due to the salmonella outbreak. The tainted mangoes have been linked to one large-scale grower in Mexico, Agricola Daniela. This week, Walmart joined Cargill, Kellogg, and the National Corn Growers Association by becoming a member of the Field to Market Alliance, a group aimed at making agriculture more environmentally friendly. Walmart is now the group's largest member. The retail giant hopes to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 20 million tons by the end of 2015. And results are in from a 25-year-long study of calories. Rhesus monkeys that were fed 30% fewer calories did not live longer than monkeys eating a normal diet. This seems to contradict results from a similar study from 2009 that showed a slight correlation between fewer calories and longer lives. Researchers point out, however, that monkeys in the 2009 study that were not on the restricted diet were allowed to eat as much as they wanted. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org.
And follow foodie news updates all week long on our Twitter feed and Facebook page. Write a comment to add your voice to the conversation. Find us by searching for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow, always good to see you.
My pleasure.
In the past 20 years, the human population of Kansas has remained fairly stable. Not so for the dairy cow population, which has increased by 50%. Justine Grieve, reporting from Western Kansas for Harvest Public Media, looks at the state's changing dairy industry and its efforts to keep the milk money flowing in.
Early explorers called Kansas the Great American Desert. For dairy farmer T.J. Curtis, it's the land of milk and honey, with an emphasis on the milk.
So this is the milk room, and we're kind of going backwards on the flow.
Curtis oversees the day-to-day operations at Forget-Me-Not Farms outside Cimarron, Kansas. The family-owned dairy operated for years in New Mexico.
You know, in New Mexico, we got to looking around, and we had a lot of neighbors. Eastern New Mexico was becoming a hotbed of dairies, and so we were starting to compete with our neighbors for land and for food, for feed, and for water resources, so on and so forth.
In 2008, the family packed up 7,000 of their cows and brought them to Kansas.
We like Kansas because sparse, there's a lot of feed, and the climate was favorable to our style of dairy.
It might seem like a bad idea to start up a dairy in hot, dry western Kansas, but the production numbers tell another story. The herd of forget-me-not cows produces about 80,000 gallons of milk each day. George Blush is the dairy program manager for the State Department of Agriculture.
Production in southwest Kansas, I think production per cow ranks 9th out of the 50 states because we provide the cows with everything they need.
Kansas may not be known as a dairy state, but Blush says it's quickly becoming one.
I've worked with the dairy program for the Department of Agriculture since 1985. When I started, we had over 2,500 dairy farms. We're down to 300 dairy farms. But in that time, the amount of milk produced in Kansas has almost doubled.
Much of the growth has occurred in the state's western third. The region has 24 large dairy farms. Together, they account for 70% of milk produced in Kansas. Like forget-me-not farms, many of these new dairies relocated or expanded from out of state. Blush says the area also has more local upstarts.
The most recent large dairies that we've got in southwest Kansas, where the growth is taking place now, are southwestern Kansas people who have realized that dairy is a profitable agricultural operation.
State leaders say the dairy push is all about strengthening rural economies that have suffered. 77 of the 105 Kansas counties have fewer people than they did 10 years ago. In the western half of the state, only 7 counties grew. With an aging population and jobs moving elsewhere, projections for the future aren't hopeful. Building up the state's dairy industry may be a logical solution.
The cattle are right there. We have wide open spaces. We're used to working with animals.
That's Pat George, Secretary of Commerce. His department, along with the Department of Agriculture, is making it known that Kansas needs more cowbell. They tout Kansas at dairy conventions, press conferences, and on their websites. The State House is also on board. The legislature recently lowered taxes for small businesses, and the Rural Opportunity Zone program offers incentives for individuals moving to western Kansas. On top of that, George says the state also has sensible dairy regulations.
I don't want to say they don't have common sense in California, but it's a little different type of common sense here in Kansas. You know, we don't need a lot of regulations. Kansans are just good at doing it. That's what we've done for a couple hundred years.
So far, the plan seems to be working. And as the cow population increases, the state becomes even more attractive to dairy-related businesses. Case in point, Kansas Dairy Ingredients, set to open next year in Hugoton, in the southwest corner of the state. The plant will be churning up and churning out dairy ingredients and eventually cheese products. The milk going into the factory will come from surrounding dairies. Tim Gomez is the company's chief operating officer. He says the concentration of dairy farms was one factor that attracted the company to Kansas.
The location is excellent in terms to where the dairy farmers that we're going to be working with. So we're able to reduce the transportation costs, getting milk from the farm to the plant. And so it made good sense for not only us, but for Hugoton as well as the farmers in that area of Kansas.
Kansas Dairy Ingredients will be working closely with Kraft, one of the world's largest food corporations. In a separate deal, yogurt giant Danone announced a partnership with McCarty Dairies in Rexford, Kansas. Soon, McCarty will supply all the milk for Danone's Fort Worth, Texas plant. Commerce Secretary Pat George says this is great news for Kansas.
Here are two industries. Both of them will have 40 to 60 jobs, and then they'll expand upon that. So those are two huge things for western Kansas.
He says agriculture is mother's milk to the Midwest, and state leaders plan to milk that for all it's worth.
We're much more focused on what we do well here in Kansas now. You know, we realize probably not going to be Silicon Valley 3. In western Kansas, this fits nicely with what they do, and they can do it well, and our natural resources fit well with this production.
To bring more people into Kansas, it looks like the first step may be bringing in more cows. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Justine Grieve.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org.
Keep these nets on them so the deers don't eat them.
Oh, do deer like okra?
Well, today we are back at the Orr Homestead, Columbus, Indiana, and we're going to pick some okra. Now, what do you think about okra?
I love deep-fried okra.
Uh-huh. And what do you think of, like, stewed okra? Have you ever had that?
Never had it. Is that what you're making for me today?
No, that actually, a lot of people don't like that. Everyone likes fried okra.
Yeah,
everybody likes everything fried. Okay, but the stewed okra gets this kind of kind of sliminess to it that a lot of people don't find appealing. I mean, people from Brazil love it and people from the South love it. But if you haven't been raised on it, it can be a little bit creepy. So today we're going to actually have okra that is raw. And we're picking some, look, see this okra here? It looks kind of like a finger. And actually in the Caribbean, they call it ladies' fingers. And you see the flower here? It's a type of a hibiscus. So, you know, it flowers, the fruit comes right off the flower. And what you want to do is to pick them when they're really small. I like them when they're about an inch long. These purple ones are called burgundy okra, and they're really pretty, too. And they'll be nice in this raw salad. Once you cook them, the color kind of goes a little off. So they're really wonderful, eaten raw. I found a few more of these, and it's kind of one of the joys of summer is to go out there and harvest okra. It takes off. You find new ones every day. There's always a few that you've forgotten, and they get too big, and it's always a challenge to stay on top of it.
What happens when they get too big?
They get very fibrous, so you'd really have to stew them a long time to make them edible. So when they're really small and young and tender, actually, why don't you try one of these just right off the plant? Isn't that nice?
Doesn't even need to be deep fried.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's great just like that. So that's how we're going to actually eat them today, is just tossed in kind of a southern Indiana vinaigrette. And that's it. We've got a nice little handful. It's enough for a couple salads here. So here we go. Simple summer salad. Ingredients that come out of any garden that's of any decent size here in the Midwest. So we have got our tomatoes. I've got several different varieties. I've got some nice golden ones and some red zebra tomatoes. I've got some red onions, some tomatillos, a little bit of garlic chili, and the okra. We can do about equal amounts. I would say if you have about a cup to a cup and a half of each of those vegetables, that would be fine. And if you like something, put more in. You could add some cucumber if you'd like. So we're just going to add those to the bowl. The tomatoes, the onions, garlic. The garlic is all minced up nice and fine. Now for flavoring, I'm going to put a few chili rings. Now these are that I'm using are cayenne, so they're these little red ones. They're quite spicy, but we're not going to use that many of them. And we're going to add a little lemon zest, which, you know, lemon zest gives you that nice citrusy, zesty taste. Okay, and we're going to finish it with the okra. Now, with the okra, I'm just going to cut them in half lengthwise so you really can see what they are. I'm going to leave the little tops on them, because they're so young and tender, you don't need to worry about those being tough or chewy. And this would be a perfect accompaniment to a grilled item. You could do it with grilled chicken or grilled pork, or yeah, just on its own with some nice salad greens. All right, now we're going to drizzle that with a little bit of honey, probably about a tablespoon. Okay, and then what's important about this salad is that you put the vinegar on. And what the vinegar does is it keeps that kind of filmy, slimy stuff from forming. So it's very important you get that vinegar on early, right after you cut them. Okay, and we're just going to put a touch of olive oil in, a little salt and pepper. Freshly ground pepper always. And I usually like black pepper. All peppercorns are actually from the same plant. A green peppercorn, white peppercorn, and black peppercorn are all just different ages of the peppercorn. So green peppercorn's the young one, and it's still tender, and you usually find those either pickled or frozen or freeze-dried. Then you have the black peppercorn, which is a green peppercorn that's been dried. So that has more of a perfume to it. A white peppercorn is a little harder, and it's a fully matured peppercorn, and it has more heat and less perfume. So it's all the same plant. It's all from the same plant, but it's just a different age of maturity. All right, and that's all there is to the salad. You can see it looks almost like carnival time. It's, it's so colorful and vibrant.
See photos of this gorgeous dish on our website, Our blogger Natalie Ray Good has also just posted a recipe for vegan Swiss-style breakfast potatoes, and a fun post about juicing is on the site as well. Amanda Schoonover has written up a number of regionally specific juice recipes using local seasonal ingredients. Check it out and get your culinary juices flowing at eartheats.org. Coming up...
So far, I've never met anybody who doesn't know what a ball jar is, even if they've never canned.
That's Karen Vincent, Director of Collections for the Minnetrista Cultural Center. Josephine McRobbie of Traditional Arts Indiana visits with her to get the lowdown on the history of food preservation giant, the Ball Corporation. She discovers some unsavory facts along the way. Stick with us for that.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh local organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors who have written everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Our book today is The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food by Janice Ray.
You know, it's a meditation to garden, because when you're gardening, you don't think about anything else. You're involved in the moment.
Ray has been gardening for 25 years. Saving seeds was a natural extension of that. As she says, every morsel of food we eat starts with a seed.
When I was writing the book, I was trying to remember specific incidents that had happened to me in the garden. It was very difficult because I'm not thinking about, oh, I need to write this down, and well, this would make a great story. I'm really just there.
Here's 1 minute with author Janice Ray.
Our seed supply is in crisis. This three multinational companies control half of the seed market globally. The seeds are being patented at a rapid rate, and not just laboratory inventions of hybrid seeds and genetically modified seeds, but also old, ancient, heritage, heirloom varieties being patented. That's worrisome to me, because that is the control of our food supply, meaning our seed supply is our food supply. I believe that it is a farmer's right to save seeds. I think seeds belong to the great commons of life, like air and water and fire and the ocean. Necessarily, we need sovereignty over our seed supply, which ensures all these wonderful tastes, and it ensures agro-diversity. The more diverse any system, the less the potential for its collapse.
Yeah, enjoy your day.
Thanks.
Bye. Hear more from Janice Ray on our website. She talks about the very involved process of hand pollinating a pumpkin plant to ensure the purity of the seed. Read that at eartheats.org. Tis the season for food preservation. Cucumbers become pickles, tomatoes turn into sauce, and watermelon rinds are candied. Josephine McRobbie of Traditional Arts Indiana explores the one thing that makes canning, pickling, and other methods of food preservation possible, the container. She speaks with Karen Vincent, Director of Collections for Minnetrista Cultural Center in Muncie, Indiana, to learn about the history of the Ball Corporation.
Muncie, in East Central Indiana, is deeply associated with the legacy of the Ball family, for whom Ball State University is named. The five Ball brothers founded the Ball Corporation in the late 1800s.
The Ball family is originally from, or moved to Muncie from Buffalo, New York. They started a manufacturing company in Buffalo in about 1880. They really did not intend originally to move from Buffalo, but just simply to build a branch factory. They came to the Midwest because of the natural gas boom in the late 1800s and visited several cities, came to Muncie, and the brothers were offered a very sweet deal by the leading businessmen in Muncie, which included cash, property, and 5 years free access to the natural gas. They started building their plant here in 1887, made their first glass product here in March of 88, and just went from there. By the late 1890s, they were all here, built their homes along the boulevard, and lived the rest of their lives all next door to each other.
Though the Ball Corporation is no longer centered in Muncie, it was a giant in the community and economy for over 100 years. Now it's a large part of local heritage, centered at the Minnetrista Cultural Center. Karen Vinson is the director of collections for Minnetrista, a museum home to a large archive of items of importance to the area, a number of which are food-related.
Muncie and Delaware County and the surrounding counties and the early part, late part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, were very much manufacturers of household products. So besides jars, and not just Ball, but a number of others, stoves, the Hoosier-style cabinets made in Elwood in Newcastle, Muncie pottery, Ontario Manufacturing in Muncie made silverware.
Among other items, Karen supervises 700 or 800 Ball jars and other jars made in the area, some of which are from companies Ball bought out.
It's easy for me to talk to anybody, any place in this country, and say, we were founded by the Ball family, and say, of the Ball jar, because so far I've never met anybody who doesn't know what a Ball jar is, even if they've never canned.
Karen agreed to show me around the archives.
You know, I come from a long line of women who don't can, but for me it's the stories that go behind the jar that I think are the really interesting part.
For instance, in the 1940s,
workers a lot of time would use the scrap glass and make things after hours, and the company actually encouraged them to do that because they felt like it was a skill-building thing. Now, we have a lot of other smaller things where they've taken a Ball jar and kind of melded it and make it look like a top hat, put a brim on it. We also have something that certainly wasn't sanctioned by the company. We have a jar and then the bottom of the jar with plan symbols on it. Now, we have absolutely no indication that any of the Ball family were ever in the Klan, but because they would allow people, their workers, to use these the cullet and whatever was left over, they made these Klan jars. One of them has the robed figure, and the other one has a fiery cross on it.
The other most requested item in the archive is of a different variety.
Several siblings, back probably in the 1930s, buried their pet canary in a Ball jar. And when they got back together one time at the family home when they were adults, sometime in the early 50s, they decided to dig it up, see if it was still there. So they dug it up. You could still see the canary, feathers and all. Well, they contacted George Ball and asked him if he'd be interested in having it, and he said yes. So they sent it to him, and we now have it.
Most of the items in the collection wouldn't go for much money on eBay or at auction. An exception are jars that have been modified to perform some new task.
This might have been a sugar dispenser. We have attachments that you would use as chicken feeders. I've seen them attached to oil cans. There's a historical society near here that has an iron lung from the TB epidemic there's a Ball jar on it that is actually part of the mechanism.
It's clear from this that Ball's legacy in Muncie lives on. Minnetrista also facilitates food preservation in their community through educational workshops, where groups learn the history of home canning, practice the hot water method, and take home a jar of their finished product. I stopped by a pre-workshop cook session at Minna Trista, where educational staff were working on a test run of a champagne blush jelly.
It's a fairly easy recipe as far as ingredients go. It's sugar, champagne, and
raspberry juice.
Educator Ashley Lichtenbarger and visitor services manager Tanya Brock ran me through the game plan.
We just combined the two juices. There's lemon juice and raspberry juice. And then you have to let that boil with the pectin, which is the gelling agent. And then you need to let it boil, and then you add in the sugar. And then you bring it to a boil and let it boil for about a minute, probably a little bit longer in this case. And then after that, then you add in your champagne, and then you put it in a processing water bath, which is the thing that makes it, preserves it, can, so that it seals the jars and all of that, and gets all the bacteria out and all of that good stuff.
The champagne blush jelly might seem like an unusual choice, but it was picked for a reason.
In our canning workshops, we are trying to get people educated on a variety of levels. So whether that's the novice who's never even seen anyone can, learning the basics, or the person who's been canning for 70 years, getting them all at the same playing field of these are the modern scientific guidelines behind canning. And then we sprinkle in the history and the art. We try to highlight modern recipes, for example, like the champagne blush jelly, obviously a more modern recipe than minced meat, for example. So that is in response to trying to keep what we're doing very relevant, but with a nice nod to the traditional canning method.
Tanya, who's from Plainfield, Indiana, has been running canning workshops on and off since 1999 and has canned her whole life with periods of inactivity.
I can remember making grape jelly with Mom, and it was just part of what she did. And then when I started here, I don't know, 13 years ago, and I can remember my very first day calling my mom going, oh my goodness, I'm working for a place that has ball jars on display. Like, it was just everyday items, and I thought, really? As romantic as it sounds to say that I've been canning my whole life, obviously I wasn't cognizant of what I was doing. It was just, yeah, something that you did. But then bringing all that to fruition, working here, and realizing that, yeah, this actually is a way that people have been surviving over time and providing for themselves.
Traditional Arts Indiana's second serving series focuses on traditional foods in Indiana. Hear more from Josephine McRobbie and the entire team on their website, traditionalartsindiana.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible. Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Josephine McRobbie, Daniel Orr, Mia Partlow, Janice Ray, and everyone at Harvest Public Media and Traditional Arts Indiana. Read news articles, find recipes, listen to archived episodes of the show, and join the conversation all on our website, eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Next week on Earth Eats, the first of a two-part series talking about raising chickens. Three veterans of backyard chicken farming come into the Earth Eats studio to answer your questions. Be sure to come back for that. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.